The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy, but
we have made it to start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. We have a very exciting and interesting program for you tonight, and I apologize for phone line connection problems with Australia. Sometimes this happens, but I am going to shorten the upfront announcements and the sponsor break so that we can maximize our time with our guest tonight rather than doing all the bureaucratic stuff that I usually do at the top of each show. So let me just leave it at, make sure you visit our website and check the details on the upcoming shows and the website newsletter. Remember, you can send comments and all before a show and during a show on the upcoming menu on the far right. Just go to the show that's listed there, and I will get your post sent to me. And if it's before or during the show, that's a good way to send in questions or comments. And then a couple of other things that I will just mention. It's important that you give us a call tonight. Phone calls are always preferred over email. But the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. So remember, there are no call screeners, and let it ring, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. For those of you not doing not doing the phone lines for whatever reason, email does work fine, and it is Dr. Space, DrSpace, @thespaceshow.com. I'm going to skip over quite a few of the other announcements, but let me do say that we are a 501c3 nonprofit. And the way the Space Show works and stays on air and brings you these programs is that many of you do financially contribute to and support the Space Show, and we really appreciate that. Without your support and without your sponsorship, we would not be doing this program. So remember, we are a nonprofit, 501c3, and if you're paying federal U.S. taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And in California, we're considered a California public benefit corporation. And if you are paying California taxes, you also get a tax deduction for your gift. Let me just say also that we are podcasting, and we thank Digidial for that. So we're in iTunes and a host of other places on the net. Let me know if you have any podcasting questions. And then in addition, remember that we are trademarked and copyrighted. You can download and share our shows, but don't do anything commercial with them. Don't edit our shows at all and put them up on YouTube or anything like that. And no written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal usage. And do read our full copyright statement at the bottom of each website page and OneGiantLeapFoundation.org website page. Do note our sponsors on their banner ads on our homepage. Check them out from time to time. And because we're getting a late start, I'm going to forego reading our sponsor messages, but do let me thank the Integrated Space Analytics for their Integrated Space Plan. They're a terrific sponsor, and we appreciate your support. Orbital ATK is also an outstanding sponsor and aerospace and defense technologies company, and we certainly welcome and appreciate their support. The AIAA as well, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and the head of it, Sandy Magnus, Dr. Sandy Magnus, and former astronaut, is coming on the show September 6th. It's going to be a morning show, even though it's Tuesday. And we're going to talk about some articles she's recently written, as well as Space 2016. And then Celestis, which is the global premier space memorial service. They are also a terrific sponsor, and we appreciate their being with us as well. And that brings me to our program tonight. So I'm very happy for the very first time to meet on the telephone and to introduce all of you from Australia. Wallace Thornhill, or Wal Thornhill, and his bio is impressive. It is very extensive, and I urge all of you to read it. And it is on the website. You can read it in full. But I'm just going to hit one or two highlights. He is on the program to talk about the electric universe, which is a broad synthesis of ideas that he created in collaboration with David Talbot quite a while ago. I think it was presented at a world conference in Portland, Oregon in January 1997. And then he has been presenting at global conferences and lectures and speaking opportunities on this and developing it all the way. And that's what we're going to talk about. So do please read his very impressive bio. But to save time and to have a more interesting show rather than me reading two or three pages to you, Wal, if I can call you that and address you informally, welcome to the Space Show and thank you for being here.
Certainly, and thanks very much, David, for the invitation.
My pleasure. So actually, several listeners have been requesting that I do a program on the electric universe. And so they got me your information, and I appreciate that. So here you are. You are here by demand and request, Wal. So start us out, because many of us may not know what is meant by the electric universe and what you're talking about. So a quick sort of 101 basic overview, and then we can go deeper.
Okay. Well, the first question to ask, I think, is why do we need a different cosmology to the one we already have? Well, I could draw attention to all of the books that are being written recently, which are calling for a new paradigm, both in particle physics and cosmology, because of all the problems that are being faced. For instance, there's the book Not Even Wrong by Peter Voigt, dealing with particle physics. Another one on the same topic as Lee Smolin's, The Trouble with Physics. And then there are two very comprehensive, one very comprehensive and one detailed book on the Higgs boson, and that's called Bankrupting Physics and the Higgs Fate by Alexander Unzicker, and I recommend any of those. At the same time, it's not generally known because of the juggernaut of modern science and its institutionalization, that there are thousands of scientists around the world who are questioning the very basics of what we're being taught. And a very good book on that subject is Old Physics for New by Thomas E. Phipps, Jr. Anyway, the basic problem that's being faced, I think, and that has to be addressed, is that theoretical physics has been overtaken by mathematicians. Neil Turok gave a session last year at the Perimeter Institute in Canada. And it was called The Astonishing Simplicity of Everything. Now, that's a pretty bold claim because it implies that you know everything. And what did he do? He began with Pythagoras and went through imaginary numbers used to solve equations and so on. And practically the whole talk was about mathematics. And this is a problem because mathematics is not physics, pardon me. It's a description of observations. It's a shorthand, if you like. And the important thing is that you must, as a physicist, know what each symbol on that blackboard means. And it comes as a surprise to most people that even E equals mc squared, which is the equation that everyone knows, but no one understands, simply because energy and mass are not defined. You won't find a definition in terms of matter in any textbook. That means that although the equation describes what we observe, there is no basic understanding behind it. And this gets down to the problems in particle physics. The other problem for cosmology is that it has never really divorced from religion. And that's understandable because it asks the big questions, you know. Why are we here? How did we get here? How was the universe created? And what's its future? And what's our role? Where do we fit in this big picture? So Big Bang cosmology grew out of religion. The idea was put forward by a Roman Catholic priest, Georges Lemaître, who was also a physicist and mathematician. So that's the kind of background that we're working against. Now, when I said that modern science is a kind of juggernaut and you don't get any, investigative journalism in cosmology, there is an alternative, fully peer-reviewed cosmology known as plasma cosmology, and that is recognized by the Institute for Electronic and Electrical Engineers. It's one of the biggest professional organizations on the planet. Now, I've attended their meetings in the past, and there's only one astronomer that ever came, as far as I'm aware, and that was Gerard Bourchier, who's a radio astronomer. And his interest was in the notion that the magnetic fields that he was deciphering from the radio signals were created by electric currents. And this is the basic tenet of plasma cosmology, that electric currents must be the source of the magnetic fields that are ubiquitous throughout the universe. And it's funny in that regard. Here in Canberra, where I live, the National University's Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics is only 20 minutes' drive from here, and I attend a lot of their meetings. And the director of that department a few years ago had the honesty to admit in front of an audience of general science that when astronomers don't understand something, they blame it on magnetism. And I'm afraid it's still true. Whereas the plasma cosmologists go deeper than that and look for the cause. You know, magnetism is an effect, it's not a cause. So this is trying to get to the cause of things. The other thing is that plasma cosmology has been very successful in predicting things that are surprising astronomers. One of them is the formation of stars along glowing filaments in molecular clouds. Now, that's predicted on the basis that electric currents through a plasma take the form of thin filaments. Everyone's seen those novelty plasma balls and how those writhing filaments inside look almost as if they're alive. Well, on the big scale, plasma behaves just the same. But in those dusty clouds, what it does is it coalesces material much more powerfully than gravity can ever do, and it concentrates it into a string of objects along a filament. So they actually predicted what's been found recently by our infrared telescopes, like the Herschel telescope. Now, the electric universe goes further. It adopts plasma cosmology as a foundational idea, and a foundational model. But then it goes on to look at particle physics and stellar physics, because both of those need addressing as well. Nothing that we observe on or above the sun conforms to the standard model, the expectation that the sun is just there trying to get rid of energy from its core. The best example in favor of questioning that idea is the fact that sunspots are dark. If you clear the photosphere and can see deeper into the sun, you would expect to see a much brighter spot instead of a darker spot. And this needs addressing. Just to say that magnetism stops the heat from getting out is not sufficient. It's another case of invoking magnetism as a cause when it's only an effect. The other thing is that Hans Alfvén, the father of plasma cosmology and the Nobel Prize winner for plasma physics, pointed out that circuitry in space must be addressed in any theory of both the sun and the solar system and the interaction with planets, and also between stars and the galaxy itself. So the electric universe adopts Hans Alfvén's criteria for looking at circuitry of the universe. The other thing is that modern physics has this tendency to feel that new forces and new particles have to be introduced whenever a problem is struck. That's all very well, but it means that in the case of dark matter, for instance, if your gravitational theory is not working and it's off by 90%, then there's a good indication that you're using the wrong model or the wrong theory, and the electric universe accepts that as a fact and then looks for an answer in plasma cosmology. This has all sorts of ramifications, but it gives you an idea that the electric universe goes back to first principles and classical approach to physics, and that means simplification. And the simplification of the electric universe goes to the extreme of saying that there is only a single force necessary to explain all the other forces, and that is the electric force. So that gives you a quick pot of overview, and of course that raises a million questions.
So let me first go at it this way, because I do a fair number of interviews with physicists and cosmologists and astronomers, and occasionally a listener will ask them about the electric universe. So all these guys are mainstream, okay? You know, they're like at Harvard, or they're at the University of Colorado or Arizona, or, you know, wherever. Maybe they're even a media theoretical physicist or something like that, but they've, you know, built up a really good name for what they do. And they talk about out of the box, kind of fringe, on the edge theories, the burden of proof is on the people proposing these ideas to come up with testable parts of their theories that can validate or verify what they're doing, and since they can't do that, all of this is dismissed by them. So you've got a huge albatross, so to speak, around your neck. So I just did a show, for example, with a plasma physicist, Dr. John Brandenburg, who has developed what he calls the gem unification theory of gravity and electromagnetism, and I'm being condemned for giving him a microphone. Okay, people who do this, and the process for the out of the box people is really challenging and hard, and I'm not really complaining about that, because maybe the burden of proof is on you and others. So how do you advance the theory behind the electric universe? How do you get it to be more widely accepted, and can you break through this peer review hierarchy that just, you know, says screw anybody who is going to come in with an alternative idea? You're not getting in unless you can prove it 100 times over, and then even then we may think twice about it. You may not be allowed in our club.
I know
peer review is very political, but it is what's out there, and they do put up pretty hard barriers to get accepted. So, but how do you advance electric universe, because the burden of proof is definitely, like it or not, on you and those supporting the theory? You don't get to vote on that, so to speak.
Yeah. I recognized that very early on and decided that playing the academic game would get me nowhere, because they'll shift the goalpost if necessary. But the thing is, this old truism that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof,
right,
is actually not correct. It's the reverse. It's those firmly held beliefs of scientists require extraordinary disproof, because the disproof, as some of these books have shown that I mentioned early on, a legion. You know, they're everywhere. There are gaping holes in modern physics. There is no understanding of the structure of matter, so we can't talk about creation of the universe until we understand what that means physically. There is no understanding of that. So a lot of the science, that so-called science we're taught today, is just a story. In fact, there was a famous poet who said that the universe is not made from atoms, it's made from stories. And at present, that's true. Now, from my point of view, I have, ever since I left university, I began postgraduate research at Melbourne University, but very quickly realized that there's no place in academia for a heretic, which I was already a heretic then, because I kept asking awkward questions without getting good answers or even getting hostility. So I realized that that was no place for me to be. So I went out and got into the computer industry, but at the same time, I kept up my independent research, which has lasted a lifetime. And it's taken me all of this time to get to the point where I feel confident enough that the story I have to tell is simple enough for anyone to begin to understand. You can begin to teach it in primary school because it follows the old tradition of simplifying things and not relying on a mathematical description as being an explanation. And I would say that we are gaining traction now because a lot of well-qualified scholars are joining us and contributing. It's a very happy circumstance for me because I no longer have to do all the work, which was just becoming crippling, because the electric universe is a truly interdisciplinary approach to science. It has no boundaries between disciplines or even cultural activities like the arts and so on. And this attracts a very broad audience, and so our annual meetings, we had one in June, our next one next year is in August in Phoenix, is quite an experience because you get people from all walks of life, all kinds of education, and the feedback we get is this just makes sense. And this is all I want to hear, is that it just makes sense, because if we're ever going to gain a groundswell asking the scientists to justify their claims, many of which are unjustifiable, then I need a lot of people understanding what the real problems are.
So, but consensus is not, if you have a lot of people at the conferences supporting and saying it makes sense and you have consensus, that's not really how the scientific method works unless you're looking to change the scientific method. So,
sure.
Again, I go back to, like it or not, you're in the hot seat, and they say, come prove it. You know, come validate. Give me experiments that I can run the numbers on, and come up with the same, ratios and information and stuff that you have to demonstrate you're on the right track. And so that's what that's, as I said, it's kind of an albatross. You've got to gain traction, you've got to, in a way, enter their world and play their game to get into that kind of mainstream club, unless you want to always stay on the outside of the mainstream.
That's true. Michael Crichton, I think, said that consensus science ain't science. A show of hands does not determine the truth. But the mainstream do that all the time. I mean, you see that with climate change. It's consensus that
totally.
Man caused.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And they pass it off as science, which goes into policy that hurts a lot of people.
That's true. There are two aspects to the answer. One is that scientists are so narrowly trained these days, and also, I might say, incorrectly trained for the job, but I'll get into that. They're not taught the psychology. Human psychology comes into it. And the way people are taught these days, both in school and at university, is diametrically opposed to being able to do science because it's what they call left hemisphere training, which is a kind of survival training. It's a roadmap for your existence. The right hemisphere of the brain is the broad picture, the one. As they say, a chicken uses the left hemisphere to find the seeds amongst the dirt and the right hemisphere to prevent it from becoming somebody else's lunch. Well, students at university and at high schools are taught all of these so-called facts instead of being challenged with alternatives so that they can go away and think about it and come back with their own reasoned arguments as to which they think is better. And if they were given a decent look at the history of science, and were asked to go back and examine some of the big decisions that were made in the past, they would find that they were made by a show of hands rather than any actual logical decision. Or it was due to politics. You know, somebody happened to have the upper hand in that particular discipline at that time and would not brook any argument. And there's a couple of examples of that. So it's a case of the training today is too narrow. It's focused in the wrong way, so it doesn't get people questioning, which is what you need to have a paradigm shift. And the other aspect of it is, and this was pointed out by a brilliant scholar in England, I only came across his work a few months ago when I presented it in a potted version at the conference in June, and that is the work of Dr. Ian McGilchrist, and I recommend people have a look at his YouTube videos and so on the split brain problem. He asked the question, why is it that brains in creatures are split in two? Nature doesn't do things for no reason. And he did a meta-analysis of all the work that had been done on split brain research and found that this was the case, that the left hemisphere is focused on memorizing things, sort of having a roadmap. But if that roadmap is challenged, the first reaction is to deny what you're being told, and the next reaction is to instantly forget it. And I've seen this in my research, astronomers being repeatedly surprised by the same discovery, because when they first encountered it, it didn't fit their roadmap, and therefore they forgot about it. And then it happens again and again. And so I think this psychiatrist in England has struck on a very important aspect of the way we teach in schools and universities. The other aspect of it is that any successful model of the universe must be predictive. Now, the thing that you notice most about the reports that come back from space shots and particle accelerators, and that is that the researchers are being continually surprised by the discoveries. You know, the discovery of stars forming in strings was a surprise. The discovery of galaxies with their rotational axes aligned over vast distances was a surprise. Now, all of this was predictable from the personal cosmologist, but nobody listens to the personal cosmologist. In fact, there's no funding for it. And this is one of the big problems. If you're going to turn this Titanic of institutionalized science around, you're going to have to start funding organizations and that are saying things that the captain of the Titanic doesn't want to hear. It really is a very interesting cultural problem as well as a scientific problem. How do you actually introduce a paradigm shift? And I should say that the electric universe paradigm shift, when built on plasma cosmology, is even bigger than the Copernican paradigm shift. So that's a massive problem. And I think the only way to do it is to have as many people as possible questioning what we're doing now and these so-called facts that we're fed repeatedly on the big screen and on television and so on in these so-called science documentaries.
I have a couple of email questions. I'm going to start working them in for you. So Dana Lubich has a couple of questions for you. So here's, I'll work them in throughout the discussion. If and when the electric universe theory becomes more accepted by the scientific community, other than providing a clearer understanding of the universe, how could this new paradigm affect spaceflight technology or the method of travel in space? Would it provide new business opportunities in the field?
I think the answer is yes and yes. One of the key aspects of the electric universe that varies from Big Bang cosmology is an understanding of gravity in terms of matter interactions. And once you do that, you realize that gravity, like magnetism, two forces are very similar, are both dipolar. So the search for a magnetic monopole is a waste of time, because all it requires is the separation of charge within an atom or a particle within an atom by a very tiny amount to form an electric dipole. And the electric universe follows the idea of repeated patterns. And it says that the particles within the atom, the electron and the proton, are actually small orbital systems themselves, made up of even smaller particles. And this raises issues about how far down do you go. But just coming down that one level, down to particles being orbital systems, will provide you with an explanation of gravity. And it also explains magnetism in terms of the distortion of electrons that are being accelerated. So this is the kind of thing which will profoundly affect our understanding of how we might defeat gravity. It will also affect our understanding of gyroscopic motion. Rotating bodies do have strange interactions. And all this kind of stuff. The other aspect, of course, is to do with particle interactions at the nuclear level and the idea of fusion other than the hot fusion, as they call it, and looking at warm fusion and cold fusion. And the Russians have just, I think it was a few months ago or late last year, had a meeting where they showed that they had managed to find a technique for changing elements from one to another without all the drama of smashing nuclei together. And I think this is the path to the future and for future energy sources.
Betsy is in Portland, Oregon, of all places. She says, is the electric universe theory taught in any schools, college, high school, or graduate school that you're aware of?
It has been attempted and is being attempted by some teachers. It has to be extracurricular at present. And there is a teacher in the U.S. who spoke at one of our earlier conferences, and he had an out-of-hours Electric Universe Club where those students who were interested were provided with the Big Bang Theory and then presented with the Electric Universe Theory. And the reaction of the kids when they saw the two side by side was in regards to the Big Bang Theory, and they said, and smart people believe that. So this is what I mean about teaching. If you want to inspire kids to get involved, give them problems to solve. Let them look at arguments for and against different ideas, and that will introduce them into the scientific method. Just remembering how to do complicated mathematics is not the way to do science.
So there are a few places where it's taught mostly after hours or as a club, but it's not widely taught in curriculums that you're aware of.
No. We did have a plan for setting up educational material, but all of this requires funding and staff and all of this kind of thing. At this stage of our development, that's not possible. However, anyone who wants to have a go, so to speak, I'm happy to provide them with as much information and material as I can. And our books are written to be read with a normal high school education. There's no complicated ideas or mathematics in them. And in fact, there are some people who are volunteering to write an introduction for young kids into the Electric Universe model, because it is simple and it is a dramatic story and it is, I think, very interesting and offers all sorts of opportunities in the future for re-examining the mountains of data that we're buried under right now and making real big discoveries.
Rod sent in an email. He's in Boulder, Colorado. Hope some of the people start to call the show instead of just using emails. The problem I have with, I prefer callers rather than emails. Anyway, he wants to know, what is the biggest or most common mainstream science objection causing them to dismiss or not regard the electric universe theory?
Well, the very first one was one that was leveled against Velikovsky's book way back in 1950, Worlds in Collision. That was a bestseller on the New York Times list for months. And yet the furor raised by it actually demonstrates that cosmology has more to do with religion and beliefs than it has to do with science, because it resulted in a modern-day book burning. the Macmillan Company, the textbook publisher, was forced to transfer the rights of the book to a popular publisher, Doubleday, and they had to burn their copies of that book. But in that book, Velikovsky laid down the challenge. He threw down the gauntlet to astronomers, and he said, based on the forensic evidence that he'd compiled about the behavior of Venus, as witnessed by within the memory of mankind, electrical events take place. And he said that electricity and magnetism play a role in the celestial mechanism. Well, the response of the Harvard astronomers was almost apoplectic, and they were basically responsible for the book burning. And all they did was, in fact, they boasted they hadn't read the book, but they said it disobeyed Newton's laws, and that was sufficient for them. Now, this idea that man-made laws are fully understood and applicable throughout the universe, which is the Big Bang assumption, is really naive, and it is simply a belief. I mean, plasma cosmologists have shown that galaxies operate under electromagnetic laws, not under gravitational laws. That's why you have to invent 90% of the matter of the universe is missing with a gravitational law. So that was the major thing, understanding gravity, and that's one of the big departures between the electric universe and conventional thinking.
That's what my friend Dr. Brandenburg, the plasma physicist, is trying to do with his GEM theory. GEM stands for gravity and electromagnetism.
Maybe we should talk.
I'm gonna introduce you to him after my show or early in the morning, California time.
Mm-hmm.
He's in Wisconsin, and he delivers in the mainstream, and he gets ridiculed. But he steps forward, and he is an out-of-box thinker. And as I said, I am sometimes attacked by some listeners who put him in the kook category because he does have some far-out, ideas. But I think ideas are fair game. Expose them to the light of day, and they either sink or swim on their own merit, right? And if you have a fair world, and that's the problem. Just like in politics, you need a fair and objective world to hear things out. And, I'm sure in Australia it's pretty similar to here, that we're nowhere near a fair and objective world anymore.
No, that's true. It's very difficult to be heard if you have a dissenting voice.
Or you have a media that won't cover it. So I think I understand enough about the Big Bang theory to be able to have a reasonably intelligent conversation with someone about it. It's everyone always says, well, what comes before the Big Bang if this is the creation of the universe? And questions like that.
Yes.
What is the electric universe theory for the start of the universe? I don't even know how to ask the question. Is there an EU equivalent to the Big Bang? How did the universe get started if there is no Big Bang? We know there's not a constant model. I think that's been disproven. And we know the redshift seems to be real, correct? So how does the EU deal with, I keep thinking of the European Union, but I know that's not what we're talking about. you got to change your initials there. How do you explain the origins of the universe? I guess that's the best way to ask it.
The simple answer is we don't. And I think that's the perfect answer in our present state of ignorance. The business about the expanding universe is that, once again, we're given this story about how it was decided that the universe was expanding. What's not told to people is that Hubble himself believed that the expanding universe explanation was the least likely and that the answer would be found in some new physics. Now, it's interesting that one of his colleagues, as a young astronomer, Halton Arp, went on to, through observations alone, find that the universe is not expanding at all. It's static. And this gets down to the interpretation of redshift. He said that not only is the redshift not a measure of the motion away from us, it is actually quantized, because he was looking at quasars ejected from the centers of active galaxies and pairing them, because it ejects one either side of the galaxy. And when you do that, you can work out the difference in the redshift from the parent galaxy, and you can also see a sequence of them, because active galaxies tend to eject these objects, these quasars, along the spin axis in episodes. And when you looked at them at further distances from the active galaxy parent, he found that the redshifts seem to occur in quantized steps. Now, this shows that Hubble was right. What is happening is that the actual particles in that quasar are of a lower energy than those in our galaxy, for instance, or in the low redshift parent. What's more, Heltnarp showed that the redshift gradually decreases and the brightness increases over time. So what he said was that redshift is a measure of usefulness. It's not a measure of the speed away from us or the expanding universe. Now, he wasn't alone then, because Fred Hoyle and the astronomers Jeffrey and Margaret Burbidge, they're probably the best known ones, but there are plenty of others, checked his work and said, yes, we believe you're right. So the universe is effectively fairly static. But that then raises the issue of, well, if that's the case, and Heltnarp pointed this out, what is stopping it from all collapsing back in? Because gravity is, as far as we experience it on the Earth's surface, is always attracted. And he said the only answer is that gravity can actually be repulsive as well. And blow me down, you go back and look at Newton's work, and Newton had a colleague with a rather odd name, but he proposed that gravity was a pushing effect, and that the reason that bodies are pulled together is that they shield each other from this pushing effect from the rest of the matter in the universe. It turns out that that is the way it works, because gravity, as I said, is a dipole force. It's both attractive and repulsive, just like a magnet. When you have like poles facing one another, they become repulsive. And the electric universe model of matter and the formation of planets and stars says, yes, that's the way it would work. All of the ponderable bodies in the universe have the same pole facing outwards and the opposite pole facing inwards. And that raises all sorts of issues about the structure of bodies internally. But anyway, so the electric universe says we have no idea how the universe was created. We don't even know how matter can be created, because you can't just create it. It's really against the principles of physics, which once again means the Big Bang has got nothing to do with physics. So that's your answer. We don't know.
Is there an effort to find out the answer for that, or do you just patiently wait and maybe it shows up? Or do you have an inquisitive mind to find out the answer?
I certainly have an inquisitive mind, and the question is there. What is the ultimate structure of matter, and what is electric charge? I've got some ideas, but this is an adventure. This is an adventure of discovery, and anyone's welcome to join in. I'm always open to suggestions and other people's ideas as to where we go next. But certainly, in our present state of ignorance, as I say, we have no idea how the universe was formed or how big it is. If it's not expanding, we have no idea how big it is. We don't even know how to ask the question of what was there before the universe. It's a nonsensical question. But that gives you a more rational picture, I think, of the situation in the universe.
So we're going to take a break, but first I'm going to ask you a very challenging question from a listener in San Diego, California, and then you can respond, and then we'll take our break. So this is from Adrian in San Diego, so brace yourself, because this is going to be hard-hitting. So far, beyond, you've probably been hard-hit before, so
Oh, yes.
You're probably used to it. So far, beyond the persecution story and the usual woe-is-me sob story, the presenter has yet to define a testable experiment that would give a unique best solution with his theory. He is also misrepresenting and totally imagining high-energy collision results regarding an internal structure of the electron. Such results only yield a fundamental particle composition without internal structure or subdivisible component subparticles. Unlike what is detectable with protons and neutrons as having an internal structure so far consistent with what have been defined as quarks. If he continues to quote Velikovsky, then the speaker should consider another late-night network that would very likely be glad to accept him so far untested, unpredictive, and imagined hypothesis. Adrian, San Diego.
That's all very well. That's typical left-brain denial and also a belief in everything that he said as being a truthful picture. You've only got to look at the nucleus of an atom to realize that it doesn't make any sense. The nucleus of an atom is made up of positive charged particles, according to the standard theory, and neutral particles, the neutron. If that's the case, the energy available to destroy that nucleus instantly is enormous. It is the nuclear energy unleashed. So the question is, why does it stay together? Now, the standard answer is, of course, they just invent forces, which are then mysteries. There is no actual understanding of the forces within the nucleus or even within the subatomic particles that make up the nucleus. There is a simple electric universe answer to these questions, but it'll take too long to talk about it here. As for predictions, the electric universe has made some outrageous predictions, which have all been shown by subsequent space investigations to be correct, or at least able to be interpreted in terms of the electric universe, but not interpreted in any fashion by the, or sensible fashion, by the standard model. And I refer to my prediction of the Deep Impact mission to Comet Tempel 1, I think it was. I predicted at the time they announced the experiment, that was 4 years before I think the actual event occurred, that there would be an initial electrical flash before the main impact, and that the main impact would be much more energetic than expected, and that the discharge pattern on the comet would change afterwards. All of those predictions came true, including the initial flash, which was a total surprise. Now, the story that was made up at the time was that the projectile, this comet, this copper projectile that was put in the path of the comet, must have broken through a crust and then plowed deeper into the comet, and then the outburst came from that. It still didn't explain the fineness of the dust and so on that was released. The comet was revisited a few years later by another spacecraft, and it took photographs of the where the crater was supposed to be, and it was almost invisible. So there wasn't a crust, there wasn't a deep hole. All of the predictions I made were to be expected from the electric universe model, but had no prior indication from the standard model. And when it comes down to proving our case, we have a multi-million dollar experiment going on in Toronto right now to look at the electrical model of stars. It's in phase two. Phase one was successful. Phase two is scaling everything up to test with much more instrumentation everything that we observed in phase one. That, in my view, is an example of prediction and also experiment. The electric universe has got it all.
Okay, we're going to pause here. We're a little behind the eight ball, and we'll take our break. And listeners, we will be back, and hopefully some of you will give us a call, and we'd love to talk to you and hear what you have to say. 1-866-687-7223, and email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Back in about three. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Space Show program. I do have a caller on hold, but I'm going to hold you, caller, because I want to go over something in email. Our program tonight is about the electric universe, and our guest is in Canberra, Australia, and it is Wal Thornhill, and we're appreciative of his being with us today. So, Wal, a couple of Space Show listeners have sent me an email with an article from the University of California at Irvine Physics News, plus other sources, and this all stems from that show I told you about with Dr. Brandenburg and his GEM theory. So the headlines are UCI, which is University of California, Irvine, physicists confirm possible discovery of a fifth force of nature. Light particle could be key to understanding dark matter in the universe. Recent findings indicate the possible discovery of a previously unknown subatomic particle may be evidence of a fifth fundamental force of nature, according to a paper published in the Journal of Physical Review Letters by theoretical physicists at the University of California. So obviously I can't read the whole darn thing on the air, but it said that the mass should be 42 times greater than the electron, and that was what Brandenburg said, and the article says it's 30 times greater, which he says is pretty close in physics land. So that was one take on it. Then I sent that to Brandenburg, for example, and he claims, of course, that his GEM theory supports it, and he gives several other articles, and then he says new particle found at approximately 16.7 MeV near what he predicted by his GEM theory M, and on and on and on. And then he says new particle is possible, perturbation, and he has all sorts of math formulas that support that. So what does the electric universe have to say about developing or discovering a new force, like a fifth force? Are they on the wrong track? Do you say that this is still part of the physics compiling the electric universe, or how is something like this understood? And I know you haven't read it. You told me during the break you weren't familiar with it. So I'm not trying to ambush you. So I understand if you don't know, you know, what it is or anything like that, because I'm catching you a little off guard. I understand that.
Yeah, I can guess, though. There is this idea that if you somehow manage to prove another force or another particle, then you're in line for a Nobel Prize. You know, it's actually another case of complication. As some famous scientist once said, give a problem to a physicist and they'll overcomplicate it. The Electric Universe model of matter is a very, as I said, a simple one. It's a repeated pattern of orbiting particles which are in a resonant state. That's why they exist for a certain, you know, any length of time. Now, if you start funneling energy into a system of orbiting charged particles, you will find new resonant states. You know, you pump the energies up. It's just like an atom in an excited state. And if you go down to the subatomic particles, the same thing applies at that level too. And the very fact that you pump energy in and you get new particles is not really helpful, because there's a colossal zoo of particles now, and none of it is explained, you know, why they're, what they are, whether they actually exist in nature. Most of them exist for such a fleeting time that their usefulness in explaining the universe is highly questionable. But once again, the Electric Universe is about simplification, so you don't need an extra force. All of this idea, I think, was aimed at trying to explain or find a dark matter particle. There is no dark matter particle. It's not necessary when you understand that at the scale of galaxies, the electromagnetic force is in action. That's far more powerful than gravity, and it also operates over a longer distance. So it's more effective at creating galaxies and stars and planets and all of that kind of thing than gravity is. So you're applying the wrong model. And this is the basic problem. When you don't have a decent model for particle physics, then, which a lot of experts are saying, questioning the standard model of particles, then you have to look for something new. But people are afraid, I think, of jumping ship and trying something really new. They don't like losing sight of land.
You have a caller waiting on hold. Good evening, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. You're on the air. Go ahead for it with our guest.
Okay. I'm not a person who comes from a technical background, but I love good science. And for me, I can accept as an outsider that there are gaps in things and that maybe down the road we will find better explanations that will really revolutionize things, and a lot of previous ideas will have to be adjusted. But to me, my main concern about your theory is that I wonder when you're going to have, when you're going to work on the mathematical framework. I mean, you know, surely if the theory is sound, you can start to make measurements and lay a mathematical framework behind it, because things have to have specific relationships between them. And if you can't describe that with math, then how can you, if you can't quantify anything, then how can you ever know that it's true?
Mm-hmm. Well, Kim, the answer is that, as I said, it's based on plasma cosmology, which is peer-reviewed and is called mathematics. In fact, the mathematics of electrodynamic plasma is far more complicated than the hydrodynamic plasma that astrophysicists restrict themselves to. And it's only when you deal with the electrodynamics of plasma behavior that you can reproduce spiral galaxies and their behavior, and even details of their structure of their spiral arms, without recourse to inventing other particles or forces. So the mathematics is there. And you're quite right that once the models are, once you have the physical models in place, that is the time to apply the mathematics. When you're just making up stories based on your mathematics, then you are liable to lose the plot. And a number of great scientists have said the same thing, that just applying mathematical theory, you're likely to go astray unless you can ground that in experiment and testing your model. And a lot of the things that are being proposed today are not being confirmed. Dark matter can't be found. Dark energy is an interpretation of redshift and so on, and supernovae, and neither of them are understood properly. So if you've got the wrong model, all the mathematics in the world is not going to save you. In fact, it's liable to lead you off into the wilderness. And I would suggest that that's what's happened. But to get out of the wilderness is much harder than just retracing your steps, because you've got to find a new path.
Okay, well, I guess the thing for me would be I'd be reassured if I heard that you were moving towards a set of equations or a way of doing a set of experiments from which you could find the equations that describe how things are related to each other.
Oh, sure. In fact, I'd probably, just in that mention aside of our experiment that we're doing in Toronto, I didn't make it clear that we have independent scientists working on that, including people expert in plasma physics and all the mathematics and so on that's necessary, and people involved in the design of experiments. So we have experts working on the electric universe model right now. But, of course, this is all in its infancy, and you cannot expect to have all of the answers neatly tied up in an equation on a blackboard at this stage. But we have the interest of those people who believe that it is a viable model, and people of sufficient qualification and ability to do what you're saying.
Okay, because I did a quick search on the net, as one can do these days, because I hadn't checked it up before the show. And, you know, the first couple of things you run into are things like that some people who are proponents of this idea say that craters are caused by electric arcs instead of impacts, which to me makes no sense at all.
I see. All I'd suggest is that you read the material on the thunderbolts.info website, including some of the YouTube videos. And if you still don't believe it after seeing those, then there's nothing I can say now that will help. But certainly sure. Electrical cratering is quite distinct from impact cratering, and the telltale or the identifying signs of electrical arcing are easy to discern once you understand what they are.
Okay, so you're not saying that all craters are the result of an electrical?
No.
Okay, I don't know. You know, I wanted to try and I'm not the person to do a reality check, but I wanted to hear some sort of, you know, you've talked a lot about being that instinctively makes sense. And to me, you know, the universe is pretty complicated, and that just isn't enough for me.
Yes. I think once you understand that the universe is a kind of result of very simple principles, but when you apply them throughout the universe, the results are spectacularly, what would you say, symmetric and resonant and fractal. All of those things come about as a result of the action of the electric force on matter.
Okay. I'm not sure exactly what I was looking for. I guess, you know, I would have felt reassured by some sort of blurb of some equation or something, some...
Yes,
I guess I'll just say this. When I take a quick look at your site, you know, I personally would really like to see the map. Even if I can't understand it, it's something that I can take to somebody else and check. And in terms of pitching the argument to somebody like me, you know, that's what I want to see.
Okay. Well, as I suggested, the place to go right now would be the plasma cosmology. There is a website on plasma cosmology which has a lot of peer-reviewed literature that you can just download, and that would be a good place to start.
Okay. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling, Kim.
My pleasure.
Good night. Listeners, that opens up the line if you would like to call us, and there certainly is time for another call or two. 1-866-687-7223. And, while I have another couple of questions from this guy, Dana Lubitsch, so let me ask you another one. In some of your web pages, you speak of resonant reactors being a better alternative to today's dirty nuclear reactors. Can you please elaborate? Also, what do you think of Eric Lerner's dense plasma focus reactor. He's a frequent guest on the space show. He's trying to create commercial fusion.
Yes. I have a lot of respect for Eric Lerner's work. He actually published that book called The Big Bang Never Happened.
Right. He's talked about that on the show many times. He's a part of an alternative cosmological organization of really bright people that reject traditional theory. And he's talked about that along with his fusion energy. Every time he comes on the show, I ask him about that.
Yes, I have no real arguments against his work. I think it is important. And his work on trying to produce fusion energy or using the dense plasma focus is a very good way to do it, because nature knows how to organize plasma in ways which achieve effects the most efficiently. And nature never does things the hard way. And the plasma focus devices, if anyone looks it up, Googles it, is so simple. It's just a radial discharge, in effect. And the effects, electromagnetic effects, are something that you would not expect or predict. But it actually answers the question of what's in the centers of galaxies, because it's shown that you can concentrate all of the energy from a room full of capacitors, which is a lot of electrical energy, and focus it down into something which is only a millimeter or two across, a little tiny donut. And of course, E equals mc squared says that if you concentrate a lot of energy in a small space, it is equivalent to a lot of mass in a small space. No black hole required. So his work is important. Now, getting back to low-energy resonant nuclear reactions, there was some very interesting work done by a very talented French scientist some years ago, Louis Cobrand, who was looking at the incredible efficiency of biological chemical reactions, often mediated by light or just infrared heat and things like that. And he showed that biological enzymes are capable of bringing two atoms together and fusing the nuclei and creating another, or you know, changing the position in the periodic table of that element in a way that was necessary for the either energy or the reactions required in the cell. Now, that's been extended recently by the Russians, as I said, last year, who have shown that they have a biochemistry now where they can transmute elements from one to another. Now, the electric universe understands that in terms of what's known as the Coulomb barrier. In electronics, the Coulomb barrier is used in transistors, and there's an effect called the tunneling. And in that case, an electron comes up to a barrier which it doesn't have enough energy to go over or through. But strangely, what happens is if that barrier is thin enough, sometimes it will actually disappear on one side of the barrier and appear on the other. It appears to be able to get over barriers that are too high for it. Now, the problem with nuclear reactions is, of course, that the repulsive effect of the nuclei, they're the same charge, positive charge, is enormous. So this is why in fusion experiments they try and get the temperature up so that the particles are moving so fast that they actually penetrate the barrier and collide. The electric universe says this is a brute force and ignorance approach, because those Coulomb barriers are not a fixed barrier. And this is why the tunneling occurs, because if all particles are composites of positive and negative charge, including the nuclei particles as well, then if you bring the two nuclei together at a resonant, in a resonant fashion, so that at one instant they're actually attractive rather than repulsive, you will get low-energy nuclear reactions occurring. And I think this is the way nature does things, based on various evidence, which I can't go into now, but this means that trying to create fusion by blasting things with lasers and funneling in an awful lot of electrical energy into contorted filaments of plasma is not the way to go. It's the most difficult way of doing it.
I've done a lot of shows on LENR, mostly with Dr. Ed Storms. I don't know if you're familiar with his work or not. He's a retired Los Alamos physicist, and they've been pretty interesting, and there's a sizable following for LENR and to develop that field. So, Spatial listeners are familiar with it. We have another caller waiting to talk to you. Good evening, caller. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John from Fort Worth.
I was waiting for your call.
I've been listening to this. Well, you have to listen for a while before you even can kind of get a bearing of what this all is. There's so many different areas. Well, I guess I'll start with something. This whole thing about your ideas about nuclear and particle physics. Now, you are basically, if I'm hearing this correctly, denying the existence of the strong force as another independent force separate from gravity and electromagnetism.
Yes, it's unnecessary. If you have a nucleus which is not composed just of positive particles and neutral particles, that suggests that the electrons themselves exist within the nucleus independently, but in a state where they, on average, sit between the protons, the forces between the protons and the electrons will be four times what the repulsive force is, which means that the whole thing can be coherent. And there's no evidence necessarily that, in fact, there's some evidence against the fact that neutrons actually exist in the nucleus. We detect them when they're emitted by radioactive decay or some other effect in the nucleus, but then it's a metastable state, which decays in about 14 minutes, I think it is, the half-life, which means that the neutron is not a particle that exists in the nucleus. It only exists as a short-lived particle in the decay of a nucleus.
Well, okay, a neutron will decay into a proton, electron, and I suppose do you accept the existence of a neutrino, or is that?
Oh yes, the neutrino is essential.
Okay.
You must have a medium for light to travel in. You cannot have light traveling through a total empty space.
But there's still, even if you look at neutrons as composite of protons and electrons, you still have a net positive charge from the remaining protons, which would create a substantial repulsive force. So,
what I'm saying is that what's called the neutron in the standard periodic table is actually a proton and an electron. They are not separated. They don't form a new particle inside the nucleus. It's only when they escape from the nucleus as a pair that we have a neutron. And I think this is an important distinction because it means that nuclei themselves are resonant structures. They have structure, and we know that from nuclear experiments. But it's generally assumed that the neutron is a particle when it's inside the nucleus. I'm saying no, that's not necessary, and there is plenty of evidence that that's not the case, that the electrons and protons, a nucleus is made up of electrons and protons.
But essentially, if a neutron were to come out and just to be proton, electron, in a sense, it would be a hydrogen atom, which we were familiar with, and in a ground state, it would be a much larger item. It would occupy a lot more space.
But the electric universe is all about resonant structures, electrical structures, and what I'm suggesting is the neutron is a short-lived structure which still maintains the very close spacing of the electron and the proton that it had in the nucleus. So, you know, the pair are ejected more or less doing the same dance they were doing in the nucleus, which means it is well below the Bohr ground state. And in fact, the experiments by Blacklight Power in New Jersey suggest that the ground state of the hydrogen atom is not the lowest state for the hydrogen atom, that you can actually drop it to a fractional ground state. And I think this is certainly quite possible. It's just that quantum mechanics, and that was based on a recipe book. It's just a recipe book. There's no explanation for why quantum mechanics is as it is. There's no physical explanation. And in fact, it runs into all sorts of difficulties, you know, with entanglement and non-locality and all that kind of stuff, simply because the basic model is incomplete. We don't have a good model to explain quantum mechanics.
Well, okay. The other thing about the nuclear particles is that, of course, the mainstream physics says that they're composed of subparticles called quarks. And of course, we have done experiments, I believe, using electron beams where you scatter them off of the nuclear particles and actually find that they behave as if there are point particles inside of the proton and neutron, right? I mean,
yes. Well, this fits the electric universe model. Protons and electrons do have internal structure. But what was I going to say about that? The problem is that when you bring the idea that protons and neutrons are made up of these quarks and anti-quarks and gluons and God knows what else, it has no physical meaning. For instance, the proton is supposed to be made up of an unknown number of quarks and anti-quarks winking in and out of existence and zipping around at the speed of light. Well, that's a kind of plum pudding model, rather like the one that was initially proposed for the atom way back in J.J. Thompson's day. It's no advance on that, really. And by proposing all of these weird particles with strange properties like charm and up and down and color, which are physically meaningless, it means you're not dealing with physics. You're just making up a story to fit the mathematics. And that's not good enough. If you want to understand something, you have to have a real physical model to pin it on. Otherwise, the mathematics, as I said, can lead you astray.
Well, yeah, but I mean, but there are actual physical experiments which show the impact of these subparticles in there,
Yes, that's true. That's true, but it's the matter of interpretation. How do you interpret it? And generally what happens is that when the mathematics doesn't work, they add more fudge factors and invent new particles. And this is not the way to understand how the universe works. The original way of doing physics was to try and find some simplifying assumptions or model and try and make that work rather than adding more and more barnacles to the edifice.
Okay.
Now, I'm not alone in saying this, by the way. This is the kind of thing you'll read in these books that I mentioned at the start of the show. And they'll say it much better than I am. The thing is that I accept their arguments, and I'm trying to provide another model to look at. And this is the only way we're going to advance, is if people will actually take seriously looking at a real physical model. At present, there are none. Most of the language that's used in modern physics is meaningless, which is a pretty, that's a pretty confronting statement to make. But I watch the science programs and so on, and when people become familiar with the science of the electric universe, they say they can't watch those shows. They get angry because there's mistakes and facts which are only assumptions almost in every sentence. And this is to get back to physics, you have to reintroduce the natural philosophers and the epistemologists, the people who look at the use of language and say, what do you mean by this word? What do you mean by mass? You know, there's no definition of mass in terms of matter. This is why they built that colossal waste of money, the Higgs, the Large Hadron Collider, to find this hypothetical particle, the Higgs boson. The idea that the mass of matter is somehow due to something external to the matter is the most complicating and crazy idea I think I've ever heard.
Well, yeah, basically the reason they need to have that in their theory is because the basic theory would have all the particles being massless, right? And that's
right, and that's crazy because then they'd have no energy. But we know they have energy, and Adam Bomb tells us that.
Well, a photon is massless, and it has energy.
But a photon is one of these imaginary particles. Most of the things ending in on, like gluon and photon, are imaginary. They're not necessary. It's a
photons getting down to pretty basic things, back to the photoelectric effect and 1905, that's a physical experiment, right? That's how they explained the photoelectric effect with Einstein's
That's a description based on a physical model which doesn't work. The photoelectric effect doesn't address the polarization of the light that's coming in, and that's an electrical effect. So what are we talking about? You don't need a photon in the electric universe model. In fact, you cannot have a massless particle. There's no such thing. It's all easily explained by what is euphemistically called quantum entanglement and the progression of the electrical disturbance in a medium. And the two combined give the effect that looks as though a particle has gone from A to B. But it's not a case of a particle going from A to B. It's energy transferring from one atom to another, which is in lockstep. It's entangled, if you like, with each other.
Well, it seems like the theory that you're talking about is it's such complete odds with everything else that's being done in physics that it's going to be a very major...
Well, this is the thing. You see,
project to get anywhere with it, I mean.
If Peter White and the people like that have said there's a crisis, that we don't know where to turn. Well, the electric universe is offering a physical model of a place to turn. But, of course, the juggernaut of institutionalized science and the politics and everything are such that it's going to take... I don't know what. How bad does the crisis have to become before the change is even considered? And this is why I'm hoping that our experiments and the gradual involvement of well-trained people in the present model, those who still can bring a beginner's mind to physics, will make the difference.
Okay, now on a cosmological level, are you proposing basically a static universe? Is that as opposed to expanding one?
Yeah, that's what Houghton Arp's research showed, and that was all observational research. It wasn't theoretical.
Okay.
Actually, I'd advise, if you're interested, buying his book, Seeing Red, because that gives you a chapter and verse, the reasons why, and the odds against him being wrong, and so on. And also his ideas of what this entails for cosmology. And it is really it's a fascinating book. Those who knew him in the scientific circles called him the modern-day Galileo.
Well, it's, I don't know, I mean, it's one thing to suggest that, there are, like, plasma physics would add something very unique to, say, galactic formation and stuff like that, but it seems like you're trying to almost do a complete revisionist science through and through, almost. So it seems a little more provocative.
I haven't got a big head about this. I have relied on finding those people who I felt were the real giants of science and whose shoulders we should be standing on. If you make a mistake in the giant whose shoulders you stand on, you can be facing the wrong direction. And standing on somebody's shoulders doesn't make you any taller anyway. But I rely on the work of a number of people over the past century who have pointed the way, but no one was paying any attention or didn't want to know. And I put together the big picture. So my contribution is mainly the big picture, which puts all of this together into a coherent story. Once again, it's a story, and it can be revised and modified by those who care to look at it. But the important thing is we must have at least an alternative idea in order to make any progress. While people keep trying to fit everything to the present theory, we'll only get deeper and deeper in the mess. You need to have an alternative to look at and compare the two. And I'm perfectly happy to be shown to be wrong or to have to revise things. In fact, this has been the path that I've had to take, is revision. But if those people who can let go of all of the certainties that they were taught are the ones who come out of it and say, well, this has changed my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know, it sounds like a gargantuan project, I don't, at the least.
It is. Yeah, it's been a lifetime.
Well, I don't know if I'm totally buying it, to say the least, but at least you're sticking up for what you believe in. Let's put it that way.
Well, somebody has to.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's interesting talking to you.
Thank you very much for your call, John.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye.
We're coming up on a 2-hour program. So what have I missed asking you about, or listeners asking you about, or what else did you want to say, or what have we forgotten to say? This is your opportunity to put it out there.
Well, again, they're talking about my journey. I think it's probably good to give a little bit of background. At school, even in primary school, I was absolutely besotted with astronomy. So I'd memorize facts from the encyclopedia and then draw pictures and bore the kids in class, you know, show and tell. When I got to high school, I had teachers who knew my interest and would lend me books by Fred Hoyle and other scientists to read. But at one stage, my father, who was a war pensioner, came home from hospital with a book, Worlds in Collision by Emanuel Velikovsky, and he said, I think you might be interested in this. And so I read it. Now, my first reaction was, rather like probably many of the listeners, how can all of these experts and all of the teachers and people who I hold in great esteem be wrong? Because what he's saying was completely at odds with most of the stuff that I'd learnt up to that point. I let it rest for a couple of years, and then I was due to enter university, and I thought, I'll read the book again. And when I did, I felt that he had made a good forensic case, that is, trying to analyze information from a whole lot of unreliable witnesses from around the world, and he'd made a good connection between what he'd found and the physical sciences of the day, you know, what we now know about the Earth and its behavior and that of the planets and so on. And the case that he'd made, which is the most powerful one, was that Venus had been a comet within the memory of man. Now, that flies in the face of everything we've been taught about the clockwork Newtonian solar system. So when I got to university, I was really keen to ask questions and find out, you know, whether these ideas could be possible. But I found that rather than being the open forum that I'd expected, I was met with either answers to questions I didn't ask or outright hostility, you know, the lecturer turning on their heel and just walking away. And that really surprised me and disappointed me. So I set about trying to find out for myself, and it was that process that I began. And as I said, in the postgraduate year, I finally decided that what I was finding was so confronting and couldn't be dismissed that I left and went into the computing industry, IBM, and then the government. So, but all of that time, I was taking the opportunity where I could to visit the people who were creating a lot of heat and noise, but not much else. In fact, the local editor of the newspaper here dubbed me the boundary rider of science, because it didn't matter what subject it was, I was in there asking questions. And this is what led me over decades to finally piece together the story. And it comes from, as I said, a large number of individuals over the last century who were, I think, pointing science in the right direction while no one was listening. And so what I'm what I presented here, maybe rather adamantly, is the culmination of all of these pioneers who I feel will appear in the history books of the future.
And you talk about all of this on your website, correct, on thunderbolts.com?
It's thunderbolts.info is our main interface with the public. I began my own website years ago, holoscience.com, which sort of is a shortening of holistic science, because no subjects are taboo. If you've got a real cosmology, it should be able to address questions in any field. It has to fit. You know, you can't have a picture with pieces that don't fit. And that even comes down to life itself and consciousness. You won't see any equation on a board which includes those in standard cosmology. And I doubt that there are equations which will address those things. So the first thing to get right is a model which can actually provide ideas for experimentation and testing whether or not the electric force is paramount in the universe and is the only one required. And I think these can be done. At least it points a way of doing things that are different to what we're doing now.
Are you planning to be in the States at any conferences in the near future where people might connect with you?
Our next big annual conference, we've just had one, I'll say unfortunately, but really it was great. They get better every year. Next one is in August. I think it's mid-August in Phoenix.
Next year.
So,
next year, right?
Yeah, that's right. They're not to be missed. I expect to be back in the United States maybe the end of September, early October. I'll be visiting our experiment in Toronto, but at present there's no public meetings organized.
What is the name of the conference for people who are interested and may want to go? Do you know the actual name of it?
Oh, it'll be the Electric Universe Conference. And each year it has a different theme. This year it was elegant simplicity, because this is the feature of this big picture. It's elegantly simple. This next year it will be future science, because it points the way to doing things differently in the future.
And it's open for anyone to attend, right?
Oh, yes, yes. Normally the first night is free to the public. And the following days are paid for. And there's also global streaming on the internet.
Okay.
In fact, a lot of the information from the previous meetings are in our copious YouTube videos on the thunderbolts.info website.
What is the name of that website again?
Thunderbolts.
Oh, Thunderbolts. Okay.
Info.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's really been an interesting discussion with you, and I guess you're used to going uphill, right?
Thanks, David. Yes.
Well, it as I used to say, it puts hair on your chest, I guess, or something like that, and turns you into a man, right? To battle uphill all the time.
I understand that people suffer cognitive dyspepsia talking about this.
Listen, it's really interesting, and, you know, I'd like to see you be able to advance your work and your theories, and I think it'd be interesting to follow it. You know, I'm going to pay attention to the conference next year, and maybe there'll be some people going or something where we can get some reports on it, so
sure.
Especially if it's in Phoenix, it's not that far from where I am. So we'll probably talk to you again down the road, and I want to thank you. I mean, you've been here with us, you know, on the firing line, so to speak, for nearly 2 hours. So my hat goes off to you, and I thank you for sharing your thoughts and wisdom and talking to us and taking the heat.
Thanks very much for the invitation, David.
My pleasure. I'm sure we'll probably talk again, and I will archive this program in the morning my time, and we'll get it off to you probably be in the middle of the night your time. But I'll get it done early in the morning, and you'll probably find it there, and that'll tell you where the program is and where you can find it. And let's stay in touch, and I'm glad we met, and thank you for being a guest on the Space Show.
Yes, I'm glad, too. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Listeners, that's it for tonight. Thank you to all of those who participated, called, sent in emails. And I know, Dana, I didn't get all of your questions answered, but I think you got a pretty good idea of how your questions would be answered. And again, special thanks to Wal from Canberra, Australia, for being with us. Everybody have a great rest of the evening or day, as the case may be. And look on the upcoming menus for the Space Show programs for the rest of the week. And we look forward to more programs. And everybody, again, have a great week. Keep looking up. Good night from the Space Show.